from the newsroom of the Washington Post.
Hi, this is Vanessa Williams from the Washington Post. I'm
calling. Hey, it's Philip Rucker at the Washington Post. Do you have a minute?
Hi, this is Dan Zak.
This is Post Reports. I'm Lena Muhammad. It's Tuesday, March 23rd. Today, why the pandemic didn't stop gun violence, and the questions scientists are asking about the AstraZeneca vaccine.
Thank you, Dion. Thank you for everybody being here today. Dozens of agencies continue to investigate yesterday's mass shooting at the King Supers at 3600 Table Mesa Drive. The Boulder County Coroner's Office.
Shortly after 2:30 local time yesterday, a 21-year-old man who has now been identified as Ahmad Elissa walked into a grocery store in Boulder and started shooting.
That is reporter John Woodrow Cox.
Very shortly thereafter, the police arrived and there was a gunfight. He was wounded. A police officer was killed, as well as nine other people.
The names of the deceased: Denny Strong, 20 years old; Nevin Stadinsky, 23; Ricky Odds, 25; Trilona Barkanovyak, 49; Suzanne Fountain, 59; Terry Liker, 51; Officer Eric Talley, 51; Kevin Mahoney, 61; Lynn Murray, 62; Jody Waters, 65.
The suspect was taken into custody right about 3:30, and he's now been charged with 10 counts of murder.
None of them expected that this would be their last day here on the planet. It's a simple run for milk and eggs, you know, getting ready to shop, going in a regular way we all live our lives, something that we can all identify with, led to a complete tragedy here today. And our hearts ache for those who lost their lives, for their families, for the survivors left behind, for the survivors who were able to get out, who have scars that can't be seen but are every bit as painful.
John recently wrote a book about the impact of gun violence on children in America. He spoke with producer Rennie Svernovsky about the state of mass shootings during the pandemic.
I feel like for a while during the pandemic, it felt like maybe things like this had stopped happening. And then we saw these two high-profile shootings essentially happen back-to-back in Boulder, right, and in Atlanta. And so is it actually true? Like, have large-scale shootings actually gone down this year? What have those numbers been like?
So it's hard to define mass shootings. The way that the Post defines them is four or more people killed, usually by a lone shooter. The Post excludes things like robberies or domestic violence, things like that. But according to that definition, there were only five last year, which was a significant drop off from 2018 and 2019, when we saw, you know, two or three times that many and some very high profile school shootings, which, to be frank, is probably one of the primary reasons that we did see a drop off last year, because schools were closed. You know, other reasons are, it's hard to know entirely why we saw those drop offs, but certainly fewer people were gathering in large spaces than they had been, you know, in 2019, 2018, or any other time.
And then what about other gun deaths, things like suicides?
So that's the aspect of this that has been really overshadowed by the pandemic. 2020 was really the worst year in modern American history in terms of gun violence. There were over 41,000 people killed. There were huge increases in gun homicides. So some examples: in Milwaukee, it doubled between 2019 and 2020. They went from about 80 to about 160. Houston went from around 230 to 350. In Chicago, in 2019, there were around 450 people killed in gun homicides. That number went to nearly 700 in 2020. Mm-hmm. So this got, frankly, very little coverage last year, I think, because of the election, because of the pandemic, because people maybe could only sustain so much misery and negative news. Yeah. But we also did see increases in suicide as well. So, you know, people are just sort of waking up to this now because these tend to be the shootings that we pay attention to, but this never went away.
And then back to Boulder. I know that the city tried to ban assault weapons in 2018 as a way to prevent mass shootings, like, you know, what happened that year in Parkland, Florida, where 17 people were killed by a gunman at a high school. But then there was a 3-year legal battle over that ordinance. And then a little over a week ago, a judge struck down that ban on rifles like AR-15s. As someone who's done so much research into gun violence and assault weapons bans, do we find that they work?
So this is always a tough question to answer. There are some studies that suggest they make a difference, but the truth is it's hard to know conclusively what effect they have because the United States has spent just an abysmal amount of money studying gun violence for the past 2 decades. So in the 1990s, there was a lot of controversy over the CDC studying gun violence. And there was a man by the name of Jay Dickey who proposed an amendment that said the CDC could not use basically taxpayer money to study gun violence for any sort of political purposes. And what this did, it had such a chilling effect that it effectively ended all gun violence research for, you know, 2 decades. And that has had just a devastating effect on any kind of progress we can make. Because if the Rand Corporation has done some really good research into what works and what doesn't work, but they struggle often to say definitively what works because there just isn't enough research out there. So only in the last couple of years has Congress finally said, okay, we're going to invest in this again. But the investments have been mostly symbolic. I mean, we should be spending hundreds of millions of dollars on this research every year. We would know so much more about gun safety. But, you know, the NRA and the gun lobbyists didn't want that from the very beginning. They fought that from the start. And that lack of information, that lack of knowledge has in some ways put us in the place that we're in today. What we can say for sure is that a shooter can do considerably more harm with a semi-automatic rifle equipped with an extended magazine than they can with a handgun that fires 8 or 10 rounds. So with only one or two exceptions, the worst mass shootings in modern U.S. history were committed with these sorts of rifles.
What does the political will or the national appetite look like for gun control legislation?
In 2018, it was enormous. You know, people who were polled, this was one of their top 2 or 3 issues. The pandemic has obviously consumed everyone's life, and the election last year did that as well. But people's appetite for change has not gone away. So the gun legislation that's currently in the Senate, those are two extremely popular bills. One is to impose universal background checks so that any gun that's sold, you have to check someone's background for it. Another is to close a loophole that allows people to purchase guns before their background check comes back from the FBI. These are both widely popular, even in very conservative gun-supporting states. And yet, it's going to face an uphill battle in the Senate. And, you know, you can only conclude that's because of the gun lobby, because the constituents of these Republican senators say, overwhelmingly, we want this legislation. The senators show up to Capitol Hill and say, I'm going to vote no on this.
I know you recently wrote a book about what growing up in this culture does, specifically to children. I guess in doing all the research for that book, what did you learn?
So, you know, with these sorts of shootings, we often only think of the adults involved. The reach of gun violence in this epidemic is so much farther than anyone understands. And it's way beyond classrooms, right? It's way beyond school shootings. You know, we have lockdowns in schools that do enormous damage to kids' psyches. Not just lockdown drills, but millions of kids go through actual lockdowns every year where they think, I might get shot in my school. Beyond that, you know, there was research done in Chicago that showed when there is a homicide in a kid's neighborhood, their test scores drop the next week. What we're seeing in Colorado will affect a huge number of people. So the families of those people, the one person we really know much about right now is the officer. He had 7 children. Those are often just passing references that we see in these stories. We'll see father of 2, mother of 3. those kids are going to live with this forever. Their friends are going to live with this forever. They are absolutely victims of gun violence.
No, it's hard. It's challenging.
That's Boulder Police Chief Maris Harold. She personally knew the officer who was killed while responding to the shooting.
Yeah, I feel numb. And it's heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking to talk to victims, their families. You know, it's tragic. This officer had 7 children, ages 5 to 18. I just had that officer's whole family in my office 2 weeks ago to give him an award. And so it is personal. This is my community. I live here. And to have something like this happen so close to where you live and to know the fear in the community and to know that the officers sacrifice themselves, it's heartbreaking.
This happens somewhere every day. Someone's life is being lost to a gun every hour of every day, every minute of every day on some days. So it's a crisis that 41,000 number doesn't even begin to encapsulate, nor does the 10 dead in Colorado come close to capturing.
John Woodrow Cox is an enterprise reporter for The Post. He's also the author of the book, Children Under Fire, An American Crisis. It's out next week. He spoke to Renny Svernovsky, who also produced the story.
There's still a great deal we don't know about the killer and the motivation of the killer in Boulder, Colorado, and other critical aspects of this mass shooting.
On Tuesday afternoon, President Biden addressed the Boulder shooting. In a statement, he called for more legislation on gun control.
While we're still waiting for more information regarding the shooter, his motive, the weapons he used, the guns, the magazines, the weapons, the modifications that apparently have taken place to those weapons that are involved here, I don't need to wait another minute, let alone an hour, to take common sense steps that will save the lives in the future and to urge my colleagues in the House and Senate to act. We can ban assault weapons and high-capacity magazines in this country once again. I got that done when I was a senator. It passed. It was law for the longest time. And it brought down these mass killings. We should do it again.
Hey there, I'm Dr. Maya Shunker, and I'm a scientist who studies human behavior. Many of us have experienced a moment in our lives that changes everything, that instantly divides our life into a before and an after. On my podcast, A Slight Change of Plans, I talk to people about navigating these moments. Their stories are full of candor and hard-won wisdom. And you'll hear from scientists who teach us how we can be more resilient in the face of change. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Sadly, the AstraZeneca soap opera continues.
William Booth is the London bureau chief for The Post. He has a background in science reporting, and he's been covering the rollout of the AstraZeneca vaccine in Europe.
Yesterday, Monday, we heard that it was 79% effective against symptomatic COVID, which was great. And then today, there was an independent panel that advises the NIH.
That's the National Institutes of Health,
which oversees clinical trials, which said that early result from yesterday was possibly misleading or they had used outdated data. And so that raises some doubts that the 79% effective figure is correct. So we are kind of waiting to learn more.
What I don't understand is why weren't these concerns flagged earlier? Did they see any warning signs before?
Yes. So it's a tricky situation in the sense that the clinical trials are going on and they're producing results. Some people get COVID, some people don't get COVID. They inject this many people and the clinical trials roll on. So there wouldn't be really anything to see like early on. The problem appears to be once they release the data to AstraZeneca and Oxford, that AstraZeneca and Oxford took these numbers and concluded that their vaccine was 79% effective. What the oversight committee, the independent panel that reviews and monitors this stuff, seems to be telling us is that maybe that's too optimistic. Maybe they over-egged the pudding, as they would say in Britain.
And so the independent, like the oversight committee, what is it saying about the efficacy rate of the vaccine now?
Well, they're not really concluding what it is. I think they're just more stating that the AstraZeneca one appears to be over-optimistic, but they are suggesting that maybe the vaccine, instead of being 79% effective overall, is something like 69% or 74% effective, which is pretty darsh gun good numbers for a vaccine. And so, you know, Tony Fauci was telling the Washington Post today and telling the broadcasters today that
this is really what you call an unforced error, because the fact is, this is very likely a very good vaccine.
And he didn't quite understand why AstraZeneca might have exaggerated or took their data in the best possible light.
Why would AstraZeneca do that?
So if the company, AstraZeneca and Oxford, tried to put it in the best possible light, but it was just slightly less good than they asserted yesterday, why would they want this kind of a bungle where people are questioning, you know, how good really is it and can they believe the data? A lot of the problem with this is that these initial results are produced in press releases and interviews. And so a lot of scientists don't really have really good eyes on the data, on the whole data set, the big old pile of data. So they're just looking what the company says in, you know, 10 paragraphs. And, you know, a lot of people say that's not the best way to conduct this kind of science.
I just want to point out that this doesn't mean that people shouldn't be getting the AstraZeneca vaccine, right? Is that correct?
Well, I'm not the one to tell people what to do or not do. But I mean, I think that's completely the position of the British health regulators and the European ones. The vaccine has not been approved yet in the United States by the FDA for emergency use. But the thinking yesterday was that AstraZeneca would apply for emergency use authorization in the next few weeks. So the U.S. government has bought 300 million, and I'll repeat that, 300 million doses of this vaccine pre-ordered. So I haven't actually bought it yet, but pre-ordered. And so this was going to be one of the four vaccines probably used in the United States, or likely. Now that's a little up in the air.
It seems like the AstraZeneca vaccine from the beginning, like its rollout has been just fraught with problems. Can you walk me through some of these issues that this vaccine has specifically faced, starting when they first announced it in Britain?
AstraZeneca's had a number of problems. One of the first things they did is they kind of boldly said that they would have a vaccine very early on and that it would be successful. And that raised some eyebrows in the scientific community. Then they did clinical trials in Britain and South Africa and Brazil. And in those clinical trials, they didn't include really very many elderly people. And so there wasn't enough elderly people, older people, to say whether the vaccine was efficacious in the over 65 groups. And that was important because that's the exact group you want to protect most. And then there were some other problems with whether they gave people half dose or full dose, or whether you should take it at 4-week intervals. So you get a first jab and then you wait 4 weeks or 12 weeks. That was a question. So they've had all these little problems like this. So it's been the least smoothest running successful vaccine so far. In fact, last week, a number of European countries, big ones, France and Germany and Italy, suspended the deployment of the AstraZeneca vaccine over concerns about these kind of rare blood clots that they were seeing in some patients. Some people had received the vaccine. And the European Medicines Agency looked at this and concluded that the vaccine was still safe and effective, and that though there were concerns about some of these clusters of clots, that it wasn't enough to outweigh the risk-benefit analysis. So they decided to go forward. The link between AstraZeneca and these blood clots has certainly not been proven yet, but it was like a concern. So it made the Europeans pause, and that pause continues in some of the Nordic countries.
So we just talked about, you know, some of the issues that this vaccine has been having. What are sort of like the good things about this vaccine?
Some of the great things about this vaccine is that it works.
Right.
It works well. The initial cutoff point was it has to be vaccines had to be better than 50%. Well, this one has been 60-70%, maybe even higher. It's cheap. It's $4 a dose. And it's very transportable. You can move this vaccine around with confidence as long as you put it in an ordinary refrigerator or cooler. So this vaccine does not require sort of precious handling. You don't need to get it at a hospital. You can get it at an ordinary doctor's office or a rural clinic, you know, anywhere in the world. So that's good. And they promised they would make 3 billion doses of it. And that's a lot of doses. You know, that gets the vaccine out in the world. So those are some good things about it. The AstraZeneca and Oxford team suggested that this would be the vaccine, quote unquote, for the world. This would be the most ubiquitous vaccine out there because of its cost and the way it could be delivered. So that was the promise and the hope of this vaccine. It's had a lot of setbacks, though.
So with all of these setbacks and all the concerns that keep arising, where does AstraZeneca stand now?
Well, where does AstraZeneca stand now? AstraZeneca is kind of a bit like a boxer that keeps taking hits, but they keep making these sort of public relations missteps. And maybe what happened today, you know, with the questions from the Independent Monitoring Review Board is just another one of those. But the concern of people who want the most people vaccinated is that something like this undermines trust in the vaccine. And if it undermines trust in the AstraZeneca vaccine, it probably undermines trust in other vaccines. And the people who are running these campaigns to get as many people vaccinated as quickly as possible think of these things as sort of bad news. It's like, this is a bummer. This is not good. It makes people who are on the fence for reasonable, rational reasons have another think and not go and get their shot. So that's a big thing.
William Booth is the London Bureau Chief for The Post. Jordan Marie Smith produced the story. That's it for Post Reports. Thanks for listening. Reni Svarnovsky and Rina Flores mixed today's show. We're looking for stories about upcoming reunions after vaccination. Are you about to see your grandparents for the first time in over a year? Are you finally going back to your hairstylist? Is she going to see that you've dyed your hair purple, then pink, then green, like I have? We'd love to hear from you. Send a voice memo or an email to postreports@washpost.com telling us about your upcoming reunion, or better yet, record it. You can use the voice memo app or take a video on your phone and email that to us too. I'm Lina Muhammad. We'll be back tomorrow with more stories from The Washington Post.